The Mormon Church is well known for having a very organized institution. It wasn't always the case, though. It turns out that J. Reuben Clark and David O. McKay called a mission president to Berlin, while President Grant, who was in Europe at the time, called a different man to be mission president. Both mission presidents arrived in Berlin. What happens next? Dr. David Nelson tells a very interesting story about rival mission presidents in the Berlin-Germany mission, as well as some interactions with Adolf Hitler. Check out our conversation. Before you do that, I just want to thank all of our new subscribers. We've got Vincent and Layton and Kurt and Ralph and Tim and Mario and S. Vance. Thank you for either subscribing or commenting on our YouTube pages. We really appreciate that. It'll help us to get more people to learn about us, so thank you very much. I'd also like to point out, we have our blog as well as on Facebook. You can comment as well. The more people who share and like, the more people that will be able to know about this. So please share with your friends on Facebook, and also feel free to comment on our blog at gospeltangents.com, and I also provide some summaries at wheatandtares.org. So check those out. Now back to our conversation. It seems like there were kind of some competing mission presidents. One mission president was kind of pro-Nazi, another one was kind of anti-Nazi. Can you talk about who those mission presidents were and those dynamics?
I'm sure what you're talking about is Alfred C. Rees. Okay, Alfred C. Rees became the president of the East German mission late 1936. And he, 37, he became in 37. And he was on duty until the week before World War II started, when he had to go home because he was sick. So he was the last Mormon mission president in Berlin. His predecessor was a kindly gentleman named Roy Welker, who also accommodated the Nazis pretty well in the interest of keeping the institutional church alive. Welker's wife actually rode in a car with Hitler on several occasions. And let me explain how that. I'm going to talk about Welker and his wife, and after that we'll go on to Alfred C. Rees. Because all the action happened in the Capitol, okay? Which is why Alfred C. Rees, and I'll tell you this in a minute, fought so hard to get the Berlin Mission Presidency instead of the Frankfurt Mission Presidency, because nothing important was going on in Frankfurt at the time except trying to convert people to the church, which you're supposed to do anyway, but forget that, okay? Anyway, Roy Welker became the president of the German-Austrian mission in 1934. That was name of the mission changed in 37 to the East German mission. It was based in Berlin. His wife, Elizabeth Welker, was the mission matron, and they had four kids that they brought over. They were from Bear Lake, Idaho. And he was an educator. He was a public school teacher. He was a seminary teacher. He was a ordinary, observant, obedient, dedicated Mormon priesthood holder who had gone up the chain of command and was, because he had been a German-speaking regular missionary as a youth, he knew the language, so he was considered for, and he was appointed president of the Berlin-based mission. His wife was the one who really kind of made some news. And here's what happened. In 1936, there was the annual Nuremberg rally that happened in late August, early September. These party congresses happened every year, and that's where you had all these flashy displays of military hardware and youth in uniforms and fireworks and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, celebrations of National Socialism. You had a situation that happened there where some 900 German adolescent girls, not Mormons, but 900 German adolescent girls came home from that rally pregnant, okay? And unmarried girls, ages 14 through 17. And so there was an investigation, and in 400 cases, they could not determine who the father was because the girl had had multiple sexual partners. So this caused a stir and quite a bit of controversy in a police statement. You don't raise a lot of heck with the government in Nazi Germany. You don't go around screaming to people to supervise these kids better because you don't scream at anybody in that type of situation. But Elizabeth Welker heard about this, and there were Mormon youth in the Hitler Youth and in the Bund Deutscher Mädel, which was the League of German Girls. By 1936, the boys had to be in the Hitler Youth, and many of the girls joined the female equivalent of the Hitler Youth, the BDM, because it was fun. You know, I mean, all their friends at school were doing it, and you didn't have any majority Mormon schools there, you know, where the kids could just be happy with just the youth activities. So there were Mormon girls in the BDM, and there were Mormon girls at the Nuremberg rally, although I don't have any rule or anything on that. I've got no proof that any Mormon girl came home pregnant, but Elizabeth Welker was worried. She was worried about lax standards in Hitler Youth camps about promiscuous sexual practices. And after all, this was the time when German youth were being urged to give Hitler a baby. Okay, so she writes a letter to Gertrude Schultz Klink, who is married to an SS brigadier general, and herself she has the official title of Reichsfrauenführerin, the Empire Women's Leader. She's the head female Nazi. She is a mother of 10 children. Okay, and so she was described as Hitler's perfect woman. So she runs the female youth agency, and in fact she is the head adult woman as far as social and domestic concerns in this regard, family, home, you know, meals, you know, that kind of charity and those things. So Elizabeth Welker writes a letter to Gertrude Schultz Klink and says and expresses some worries about that. Well, a couple of Klink's assistants get in touch with her at the mission office and agree to let her tour some youth camps so she could see for herself the level of discipline enforced on German youth at these youth camps. Well, one of these trips, Schultz Klink is in the limousine with Adolf Hitler, because Adolf Hitler is going out to see the camps himself. And Schultz Klink gets picked up, and she's in the same car with Hitler. And they go out there and they inspect this camp. There were a couple other times when Schultz Klink's underlings came out and picked up her and took her to other youth meetings. In the end, Elizabeth Welker is just absolutely bamboozled and believes that the German youth German adolescent girls are the best teenage girls in the world, and they're being led better than anybody else. Certainly not a lot better than our permissive situation in the United States. And so she writes an article for the Improvement Era, where she's talking about the superior German adolescent girl. And it's just frightening to read all this, because at this time, the Nazi propaganda is talking about the superior German race. And she's talking about how the German girl wears good solid clothing and solid shoes so that she can walk 10 miles a day if she wants. And in her backpack, she doesn't have a sweet, she has a solid sandwich to provide her with nutrition. And the German girl believes in practical underwear, which is not worn to be seen. I mean, you read this thing and it's half funny as can be, and then you get to the part that says, the German girl of today has her pedigree chart on the wall in her foyer, so that when a boy comes courting, he can establish her racial purity. In other words, she doesn't have any Jewish blood in her. But the way that Elizabeth Walker is citing this is that the boy can see that she's healthy and that she's a sufficient subject for motherhood, you know. Roy Welker and his wife come home. They're doing a welcome home service in the Salt Lake Tabernacle. And Roy Welker is being interviewed by a Salt Lake Tribune reporter about the state of Germany. This is 1937. There's a lot of stories coming out, you know, in the newspaper about Germany and the Jews and all these things. And Roy Welker says, Jews in Germany today are safer than they are at any other place in the world. Now, how he came up with that, I don't know. I do know that the Nuremberg race laws were adopted in 1935, and for a very short period of time, even Jews in Germany thought that maybe, even though their citizenship had been revoked in those race laws, they were given a special protected status. They were given a special status instead of citizenship, and they thought that it was protected status. So for a very short period of time in 1935, there was a belief worldwide that perhaps the persecution against Jews is over with, and Hitler is content with stripping them of their citizenship, but they'll be protected as a special class of people, of non-resident aliens or something like that, or resident aliens in that regard. But by the end of 1935, all of the trouble hadn't stopped and all of the harassment hadn't stopped, and everybody forgot about that. Well, the only way Roy Welker could have ever said that Jews are safer in Germany than anywhere else in the United States, which was a patently ridiculous statement, was if he was 2 years behind the time and perhaps he entertained this futile belief. Otherwise, I don't know. He's complaining about the news media and the news media making more out of the situation with the Jews in Germany than it deserves. And you know, his mission office, the mission home, was in the Tiergarten, okay, known as Animal Park, but it was a big city park in the middle of Berlin. And the mission home was in a very nice place, very nice neighborhood. But across the street from the mission home and a little down the street, you had bus benches. And the benches were painted green, which was the normal bench color for everybody, or they were painted yellow. And those were the benches that Jews were allowed to sit on. So how Roy Welker could be stationed in the middle of Berlin's capital city and be there for the Olympics when they came through and they picked up all the street bums and they stopped harassing the Jews, they took the yellow benches away and all of that, and then they brought them back after the Olympics once the foreign press was gone. You know, how Roy Welker could come up with that type of verbiage, I'll never know. But Roy Welker was kind of innocent. He was kind of deceived and bamboozled by this stuff. Well, in comes Alfred C. Rees from Salt Lake City, whose latest billet had been the advertising and circulation manager for the Deseret News. Okay, Alfred C. Rees was a fantastic German linguist. He, like Roy Welker, could speak German just fluently, so well that people didn't know that he wasn't a German. And he wanted this billet. What had happened, there was a little bit of confusion. Early in 1936, I believe it was January of 36, if I got the date right, Heber J. Grant is in Germany. And what he's doing, he's celebrating 100 years of Mormonism in Europe, and so he's on a 3-month tour of Germany. the prophets here in Revelator, Heber J. Grant. And he comes to Bern, Switzerland, where the mission home is for what was then the Swiss German mission. Later on became the West German mission. He stays with the Swiss German mission president, Philemon Kelly, who's a kindly man, a doctor from Idaho, a physician, a medical doctor. And sometime during the stay, President Grant goes to President Kelly and says, "How would you like to be the mission president in Berlin?" Well, that's a plum assignment, and Philemon Kelly, "I'll take it." And he packed up and he's gone. Well, at the same time, while President Grant is gone from Salt Lake City, David O. McKay and J. Reuben Clark are calling Alfred C. Rees to be the mission president in Berlin.
The same city.
The same city. So the newspapers in Salt Lake City give goodbye editorials to Alfred C. Rees because he's one of them. He's part of the newspaper industry there. And there's no doubt he's going to Berlin. But when he gets to Berlin, he finds Philemon Kelly and his wife already installed in the mission home, in the Tiergarten. And Kelly won't give it up. So they have, in my book, I wrote write for about a month or a month and a half, these two guys are competing. No way Rees is going to turn around and go take the consolation prize at Frankfurt. So he goes and rents a home, which the mission has to pay for, down the street. And we have rival mission presidents in Berlin for this period of time. And they just cannot agree. So what they do in the interim is Rees says, "I'll take care of the political part of the government liaison. You take care of running the branches and the districts, and you take care of the missionaries." And so while they agree, they can't agree on who's going to be the mission president, they do divide the duties for a while. In the same time, so what happens is they appeal for help. They appeal for help for the European mission president, who to come from London, and he comes over and mediates with them. At the same time, there are letters being written to Salt Lake City saying, "You dispatch two Berlin mission presidents over here. Neither of them wants to go to Frankfurt." Well, after about 2 months, Kelly gets the word that Salt Lake City has said, "No, we know that President Grant told you to go there, but you really need to go to Frankfurt." And so he goes to Frankfurt, and Alfred C. Rees is there on his own, in his glory, having the most prestigious mission post in Central Europe. And he was the consummate, where, you know, Philemon Kelly was the consummate spiritual mission president. Alfred C. Rees was the consummate political mission president. And so it was his idea and his goal to wax the skis of the Mormons in Nazi Germany. It was his job to make sure that that the Mormons got along and could continue to have their American leadership and could continue to proselytize and not have any problem with the Nazi government. So Rees was a Chamber of Commerce man. And he was also a political guy. He's a Chamber of Commerce guy in Salt Lake City, and he also was part of the political movement to do away with the closed shop. It used to be in the United States that in many industrial vocations you had to be a member of the union before you got a job at at a union plant. And that was the case in 1936 and 37. It was the Roosevelt administration. The Democrats were in power. The unions had influence. And the closed shop was still, a closed shop contract still could be signed. Okay? And Alfred C. Rees was, of course, the Salt Lake City leader of the open shop lobbying effort. So what he did was he started making friends with the Nazi hierarchy and making it in such a way that he was accustomed to doing it in business circles in Salt Lake City. He would go first off to a regular weekly meetings of an organization called the German-American Chamber of Commerce. And this is where American businessmen stationed in Berlin to facilitate business with German companies and the German government would meet with their German counterparts, and they would have lunch once a week or twice a month or something like that. And Alfred C. Rees says, this is where I can meet some Nazis, or this is where I can meet some people that are high up in the Nazi government. And so he would go in there, and he would use both his command of German and his command of businessmen's English to talk to the American and German businessmen, introduce himself, and meet people, and get introductions to other people. Well, I can't help you, Mr. Rees, Herr Rees, but I know somebody over at the propaganda ministry that can help you. And so introductions, networking would be going on, okay? He would make sure, he was very, very sure, even to the point that Roy Welker never had, that the missionaries never talked politics. Missionaries never took pictures with their little cameras of policemen in the army or things like that. He wanted to make sure that the Mormon Church got along very well with the government. And so he had a breakthrough. He got a high-up contact in Joseph Goebbels' propaganda ministry. And he got the propaganda ministry to agree in the main office in Berlin, as they were the publishers of the People's Observer, the Fränkischer Beobachter, which was the official Nazi Party daily newspaper with a circulation of 1 million copies a day within Germany. He got them to agree not to run any more anti-Mormon articles. Furthermore, he got them to agree that he got the local newspapers to agree around the country to try to stop running anti-Mormon articles, and also to try to run pro-Mormon articles. He would plant pro-Mormon articles in little newspapers around Germany. And this is going on. Until one day, the Fränkischer Beobachter, the People's Observer, runs an old-style anti-Mormon article that could have been around from the 1890s. I guess they had space to fill, and they ran an old-style article, and Rees is livid about this. And he goes and puts his hat on, he puts his tie on, and he marches down to the propaganda ministry and starts chewing people out. Now you can imagine this. This is an American representative of a small, obscure religion that's not even recognized in Germany. It's recognized as a club. It's not recognized as an official. And he's going in there into Joseph Goebbels' office himself, but into the lower echelons of the management, raising Cain about this article that's written, and they say, Mr. Rees, Herr Rees, I'll tell you what. You go write a good article about the Mormons, and we'll put it in the newspaper in a couple days. So he knows when he's got the opportunity. He goes back and he writes a grammatically perfect article called Im Land der Mormonen, in the land of the Mormons, okay? And he brings it down to the Fränkischer Beobachter office, and they agree to run it. Well, lo and behold, in a couple days, on the second section above the fold, which is a pretty good place in a newspaper, there's this whole page article that jumps to the inside talking about how great that the Mormons are and how many commonalities that they have with the Germans. For example, it's a flattering description of the Salt Lake Valley and the Mormon pioneers who settled it. It compared Mormons and Germans as practical people who could appreciate each other had endured. It linked the word of wisdom with Nazi efforts to discourage German youth not to smoke. It played on German sensitivities about the Treaty of Versailles. It compared pronatalist policies. It was against the law in Germany to have an abortion, not for religious reasons, but you weren't supposed to deprive the state of productive citizens. It declared pronatalist Nazi policies with the American bans, and especially Utah's ban on abortion, and Mormon religious opposition to abortion, and Mormon religious opposition to birth control. I didn't know that, but I guess so. It linked Mormon welfare and Nazi welfare schemes. There were Mormons, especially the previous mission president I talked about, Welker, who really believed that Hitler got the winter relief program in the Nazi Germany charity program from Mormon Fast Sunday. And they believed that. They said it over and over again. And Breeze is too smart for this, but he put it in the paper. It talked about Karl Maser, the German immigrant who became president of Brigham Young Academy, later BYU. It has pictures of downtown Salt Lake City, the Salt Lake Temple Church headquarters, the BYU campus, and a separate nighttime view of the Salt Lake Temple. This is in the Nazi Party's official newspaper, not the Frankfurt or the Berlin commercial newspaper. This is the party newspaper. This has a picture of the eagle with the swastika on it, and the eagle and the talons and the big, all that. He's got that in this newspaper, and that isn't enough. So it's going to run a million copies in Germany that day, but that's not enough. He goes and gets a bunch of copies of it himself, and he and his missionaries cut the articles out and they make it into a brochure, an 8.5 by 11 brochure, or whatever the size paper was in use back then. He brings it back to the People's Observer office and gets them to print it as tracts, and it's used as missionary tracts in Germany from then on through most of the Second World War. This guy was a real pro-Nazi guy. He went, you asked about mission presidents that didn't like this. Well, there's the 1938 Mission Presidents Conference in Denmark, in Copenhagen. And nine out of 11 mission presidents are there. They didn't bring the guy from Palestine, and they didn't bring the mission president from South Africa because it was too far to go. But the mission presidents from France and the Scandinavian countries and Belgium and all of that, Switzerland, you know, all that, they're all there. And Alfred C. Rees sent them all a letter and said, I have the key to success for you guys. Okay, I can't put it in letter in writing now, but he went there and he bragged about how he had unprecedented degree of cooperation from the Nazi state. Well, his Pleman Kelly's gone now, and there's another mission president over in Frankfurt right now. And this guy, you know, was no liberal, but he did not like trusting the Nazis for anything. And he thought that Rees was pandering to them too much. And this was Michael Wood, whose wife was better known. It was Evelyn Wood, who was had invented speed reading, Evelyn Wood Reading Dynamics, which was a popular speed reading course at the time, and it went on even to President Kennedy's time. I remember seeing TV commercials about it when I was a little boy growing up in the 50s and 60s. Well, he gets in a big argument with Alfred C. Rees, says, President Rees, you can't trust these people. Besides, it's beneath us. Everybody knows what the Nazis are doing, and I see you're trying to keep the church open there in Germany, but don't be pandering these guys, and my goodness, don't put a pro-Mormon article in a Nazi propaganda newspaper. But Rees prevails. He just, and the missionaries were writing home with copies of this. One missionary wrote the Deseret News a letter to the editor talking about how things were going so well now in Germany because of because all of the articles were placing in the newspapers now. And it almost, it made it seem like the Mormons were giving their endorsement of the Hitler regime.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. David Nelson. In our next conversation, we'll talk about genealogy as well as what the Mormon missionaries did to help the German Olympic basketball team in 1936.
The German sports authorities never heard of basketball, okay? They don't have any basketball players. But because they're the home country, they feel that they have the obligation to field a team in every sport. They may go somewhere else for the Olympics and they won't do a sport, but this is Germany and everybody else is going to be bringing their basketball team over. They would look awfully bad if they had basketball competition in Germany and didn't have a team. So how do we do a team? Well, they did it very methodically. The only people that knew anything about basketball in Germany at the time were a few foreign university students from the United States and Canada, and guess who? The Mormon missionaries.
Click here to subscribe, click here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some other videos that we've done here on YouTube. We hope you'll use this as a valuable resource to learn more about Mormon history.